face, says the introduction to the Hitchhiker's Guide, is big. Really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. And so on. It also says that if you hold a lung full of air, you can survive in the total vacuum of space for about 30 seconds. But with space being really big and all, the chances of being picked up within that time are 2 to the power of 2,079,460,347 to 1 against. Which, by a staggering coincidence, is also the telephone number of the Islington flat where Arthur went to a fancy dress party and met a very nice young woman whom he totally blew it with.
Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that we had to delay the podcast by 2 days because both of us were trapped under a pile of books.
Yeah, I'm actually wearing a shirt made out of books right now. It's kind of hot in the summer, though. Absorbs sweat well, though.
We were like YA books in the summer and like Stephen King novels in the winter.
Exactly. So anyway, I'm Ben.
I'm Gabs.
And we are here this week to talk about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams.
A classic humor / sci-fi novel.
Yes, and according to some people, the only sci-fi / humor novel.
That's also true.
So we do have a spoiler policy that I can't imagine we would spoil anything with this book, given...
I hope not.
Given its age and how widely read it is and the fact that there's really not a plot anyway. But we will spoil everything, so if you haven't read it and you actually think that I could possibly say something that would spoil it for you... You're wrong, but if you think that, then now would be a good time to turn this off until you've read it.
Yeah, because the Earth blows up.
Yeah, it totally does.
That's the spoiler Ben wanted to use. Even though it does at like the end of chapter one.
Yeah, it's like one of the first things that happens in the book is the Earth blows up.
The answer to the universe, life, and everything is 42. Woo! Well, that's a joke I feel like everyone knows, even if they haven't read the book.
Yeah, it's kind of out there in the ether or some such.
In college, we got these, like, hoodies for the newspaper, and we got to put whatever number we wanted on the back. And I picked 42 because no one had picked it yet. And, it, like, almost every time I wear that hoodie, someone will be like, 42! Nice! I'm like, what? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I did that.
So before we start plumbing the depths, if that's even the right phrase to use with this book.
Are there depths?
There are not really depths.
I guess on Magrathea there are depths. On
Magrathea, they're hyperspatial
depths. They go under.
Yes. Some listener response we'd like to address briefly.
Yeah, David wrote us a short story response to The Stand.
Yes. It was 8,000 words of comments. It was actually longer than the podcast.
That's impossible.
That's impossible.
Although it's a very proper length for a book of that size.
Yeah, it was.
It's about proportional.
So anyway, I'd like to address a couple of his points. He wondered, we're not going to read the whole thing because it is lengthy, but he wondered if the racism suddenly disappearing was Stephen King commenting on once society decays, if people just have more important things to worry about, and my answer to that is no. I don't think that at all. I don't think that ever entered his head at any point, though. I think if you're going to write a paper on the book, you might toss that out there.
Yeah, I thought that was actually like a pretty good idea.
I thought it was a pretty good idea, too. I just don't think that that level of thought went into anything about this book. That's the sole place I'm coming from.
Maybe they're just afraid Mother Abigail would pimp slap them if they said anything bad.
Maybe.
A second comment was about... our discussion of island nations and if, you know, in Australia could get away with not getting the disease. And he said that he thought it'd be interesting to look at some kind of apocalyptic story on an island nation that, you know, has avoided the plague, whatever it is, but still has to deal with population, imports and exports, which they don't get anymore, you know. The example he used was Japan. if Japan imports X number of food products, and all of a sudden they can't go anywhere else because they will all get sick and potentially come back and kill everybody on the island, then how are they going to deal with that?
Yeah, and I do think it would be interesting to explore a post-apocalyptic or fully apocalyptic, in the case of The Stand, setting on an island sort of nation. And I can't think of an example of that immediately. I wouldn't be surprised if there was something similar to that out there, but...
Well, of course, the first thing that popped into my head was Lord of the Flies. It's like a pseudo-apocalypse, but not really the same
thing. Yeah, but they didn't have to deal with supply issues and being isolated from things they're used to having. And, well, I don't know. Maybe one of us or one of you people out there will just have to write it yourselves.
There you go. And then his last comment was just a quick note on our issue of not having enough female characters. And he just said, in his experience as a guy, he does tend to write more male characters and then try to stick a girl in there kind of as a, like a token, oh shit, I don't have any women.
And I can definitely see where that's coming from, because I also write a little bit from time to time. And I also have trouble putting a female character in there without reminding myself to do it. And I feel like the ones I write are usually pretty terrible.
It's just hilarious to me, because not to claim that I write good male characters, but when I come up with a cast, it's almost always evenly balanced. It might sometimes lean one way or the other, but I almost never run into a problem where I have exclusively men or exclusively women.
I'll say since I turned 25, I'm more likely to have a woman in there without having to make myself do it. But I can sympathize a little with it being difficult to write a woman who actually sounds like a woman.
Yeah, authentically.
Right. As opposed to, here's a woman character, and then you read the book, and she was really just a man that you were calling a woman. Like Heinlein.
Oh. Or, you know, well, Heinlein's other female characters.
Yeah.
This is not about that.
Yes, it's not about that at all.
This is about Douglas Adams, who is also a horrible sexist.
Really?
Oh, no, I guess not. Well, I was thinking in terms of he basically only has one female character, too.
That's also true, but technically he only has two human characters and one of them is a woman.
That's true. So technically...
I don't know how we want to classify that.
All these aliens ruining everything. Yeah, he's representing the real minorities.
That's right.
He is aliens.
People with two heads and three arms.
Apparently one of which just got sewn on.
Yeah.
To impress a girl. Oh, Zaphod.
Oh, Zaphod.
Zaphod, Zaphod.
One of those.
That's the other, that's our big issue is, when you read it, or at least when I read it, I went, oh, Zaphod. Yeah, that makes sense. But when you hear it, like in an audiobook performance or a movie, it's Zaphod. And I'd like to know the Zaphod, Zaphod debate people fall.
I'm sure both sides have their internet partisans.
The Brits are all probably like, shut up.
Yeah, maybe if you say it with the British accent, it flows better with the long A, but I can't do that, so I'm not going to.
We're from Kansas.
We're from Kansas.
So why did we choose the book?
Because, well, pretty much as we already mentioned, because everybody, it feels like, has read it. It's one of those books that people who read tend to get around to. It's definitely one that science fiction fans get around to. It's definitely one that people who like books with humor in them get around to. I probably have a couple of friends who haven't read it, but I'm pretty sure all of those people would read it if I shoved it into their hands.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I read it when I was 12 or 13, mostly just because someone's like, this book is funny, and I was like, okay. Of course, I barely remembered any of it, but...
But it was funny. It was one of those books I read numerous times between, I'm going to say, about ages 10 and 15.
Yeah, it's one of those books, too, that is laugh-out-loud funny. Like, you'll just be giggling while you read it.
There are moments. And I actually think it's a pretty influential book as far as how people's writing styles form. People who write with a little bit of humor, like kind of tongue-in-cheek, tend to have just a touch of Douglas Adams in them.
Mm-hmm.
Especially English authors, but American ones too. And I would say, actually say that this book is one of the more influential books in my own writing style. So
you don't like plot?
It just crops up. It's less the plot. It's just like the way he does the prose more.
No, I'm kidding. Jeez. Yeah, the book was popular enough to merit a big Hollywood release in the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, I don't want to try to put a date on it because I didn't bother to look it up
earlier. I don't think anyone cared, really.
But it was largely greeted...
I didn't see it.
It was largely reviewed as meh.
It's alright.
I think there were probably some people who hated it, but no one I know had a strong reaction to it.
When I listened to the first disc of an audio book performance, it wasn't just straight reading the book, it was actually, you know, with like a cast reading the different lines of dialogue. And one of the things I realized after listening to the first disc and then reading the first chunk of the book was I actually thought it lost a lot because they cut out a lot of those little, like, ridiculous narrative jokes that he kind of slips in.
Right.
Around people talking that they cut out because it doesn't fit with, like, the drama format. And I think that would be a big problem I would have with the movie, is you miss tons of those little narrative winks and jokes.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the strength of that, and for that matter, the BBC miniseries production of it, which is actually pretty fun, though cheesy as hell. The best parts are definitely both versions went into the Hitchhiker's Guide entries,
mm-hmm.
and had their little versions of those, and those were the highlight of both of those productions, because that is closer to some of the ridiculous narrative stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas some of just the little side commentary from the narrator, not so much.
Yeah, and even the really little stuff, like I think there's one point where Trillian is like lilting, or he has some kind of word he's using to describe the way she's talking, and he uses like four times on one page.
Oh, she's talking to Marvin.
She's talking to Marvin and trying to stay really cheerful. And just, like, repeating that word makes you just start laughing.
Yeah.
So, I think there's definitely some humor tucked away that would be hard to translate to just a pure performance version.
Right. Though I gather there is a radio script version that he actually wrote and adapted himself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because I think I've actually read some commentary about this book that he wrote that I'm pretty sure was tucked in with a version of that script that one of my friend's dads owned. It was sitting on a table when I was in, like, seventh grade, so I was flipping through it a little bit. And I'll just throw one of the tidbits out there. The sperm whale, there's a point where a couple of nuclear missiles are chasing them. They kick in the improbability drive, and one missile turns into a whale and the other into a pot of petunias.
Pot of petunias.
And I can't remember what the show was, but there was some detective-type show, I think it was, that Douglas Adams had been watching around the time he wrote the book. And this show had a tendency to introduce a new character and let you get to know them just a little bit and then kill them off.
Mm-hmm.
They did this on a regular basis. And so that was his inspiration for the sperm whale. He wanted to create a character
that you got to know just a little bit.
And let you live with them for a short period of time before they go away forever.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
That's also kind of a little reminiscent of The Stand. He had a couple moments like that.
Yeah.
Like, here's a page and a half of a character. Now they're dead.
Now they're dead.
Although the whale is much more funny.
It makes you care more when they die, I guess.
I liked the petunias, personally. Not again.
Oh, no. Not again.
Yeah, that's it.
There you go.
That's my big question for this series. Where did the potted petunias come from? Well, obviously, it's science fiction. We already said, like, 100 times.
And humor, and...
Yeah.
What actually happens in the book, I guess? Let's talk about what's happening in the book a little.
Okay.
So what was our plot synopsis?
Is Earth blows up. We still don't know what 42 means.
There you go. And that would sound awfully cryptic if you had never read the book.
Yeah. It actually sums it up fairly well. Two of the biggest plot points, actually, are those two things.
Yep.
And everything else just kind of like wacky misadventures. It's actually, if you want to get all literary snob, Hitchhiker's Galaxy's Guide. What the fuck am I saying? Hitchhiker's Guide is following the grand tradition of Don Quixote in its, you know, more anecdotal, like, adventure, as opposed to, like, a narrative arc.
Right, yeah.
So, okay. Well, our setting for this book, because it's sci-fi, is the universe!
The universe! It starts on Earth. I actually want to read a short excerpt from the very beginning of the book. Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 98 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. So, Earth!
Digital watches!
Which, by the way, comes back in the form of running gag a couple times.
3 times.
Oh, damn, my digital watch is broken. Or my arm's running off into the sunset. Where my watch?
Yeah. Yeah, and not surprisingly, I guess, because it's a fairly common thing for sci-fi writers to do, is the universe is so big and all these other alien life forms have been communicating with each other and doing stuff for so long that everyone's just like, Earth? Like, who cares?
Right. And on sheerly astronomical terms, if you compare Earth's location in the galaxy and the significance of our star compared to other stars in the galaxy, there's nothing special about it at all.
No.
Other than we live here, so we tend to think it's important.
We think it's the tits.
Point of view for this book is third person.
Yeah, we follow Arthur around more or less, but we do get some with Zaphod and some with Ford and some with the whale, like we were just saying.
Yeah.
I get a little flashback to the scientists and the computer. But I think one of the most significant things about this narrative style is not that it's third person, but that it's an unreliable third person narrator.
Yeah, he's not just giving you the information.
And what's kind of interesting about that is it's pretty common to read an unreliable first-person narrator because everything's filtered through that one person's point of view, and they might look at a situation differently depending on how it interests them, and you can kind of pick out sometimes in books where the first person's being just out of control. But with a third-person narrative, having that be unreliable is much different because you're used to third-person narratives being this kind of authoritative voice, just giving you a picture into what's going on.
And sometimes it'll be close, so you won't get all of the information from a scene, but it's a much more objective viewpoint, definitely. And I think that unreliable narrator is actually maybe the hallmark of his writing style. Like, I think that's definitely what Terry Pratchett is doing in the Discworld books, for example. And, you know, to name someone who does humor fantasy, since doing humor science fiction is difficult to slip past your publisher.
Other unreliable narrator that we get that's supposed to be the reliable narrator for Arthur, at least, is the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy within the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes.
Which is meta, which I'm sure Ben loves.
I do like things that are meta or things that I can call meta.
This one's actually meta.
The strength of the movie productions, as I mentioned, also arguably the best humor in the book comes from those entries. It actually makes me think very much of Wikipedia, especially early days Wikipedia before they required citations and had bands of roving editors. Because this thing is compiled, it's supposed to be an alternative to the Encyclopedia Galactica.
Mm-hmm.
And the entries are all clearly written by people who are giving their opinions on it rather than actual factual information.
Yeah.
And the way they compile the book is they just have all these roving writers and freelancers and researchers out there, and they send stuff in every once in a while, and there's not a lot of editing. They don't put everything in there to save space, but...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what their quote is. Like, they are, like, entries are selectively written and unevenly edited.
Yeah, that's what it was.
So subject has to interest a person, and then it's just a big mess. And Earth's entry is, of course, an example of that, because Ford's been stuck on Earth for 15 years on a research gig that he accidentally got stuck and can't escape, and sends in his new entry for Earth to replace the old one, which is just harmless. And they update it to mostly harmless.
Which happens to be the title of, what, like, the either the third or the fifth book in what is called a trilogy.
Yeah, the increasingly inaccurately named yes. trilogy.
That's what it said at the top of the fourth book. Yeah. Was the fourth book in the increasingly inaccurately named Hitchhiker's Trilogy.
Yeah, everything having to do with this book is just, like, tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, it's all very ridiculous.
I don't think you can run into a single serious moment. So, let's get down to the characters in this whole mess, since we've mentioned most of them by now. So, the protagonist, I'd say you'd have to go with Arthur Dent on this one.
Arthur Dent. No, you can't make him. He's not really that badass.
He's just a British dude.
Arthur Dent.
Just hangs out.
Yep. Living in his house.
And he's definitely, Ben and I were talking about categorizing all the characters kind of into the comedy trope frame, or whatever you want to call it. And Arthur is definitely the straight man in this situation.
Yeah, definitely in the first book, for sure. Because he's just got plucked off of Earth. It got blown up. He has mixed feelings about this. He actually largely doesn't care. That's kind of the funny part.
Yeah.
McDonald's bothered him. His family.
I love that.
His family being gone didn't bother him that much.
It's like trying to narrow down, okay, what can I comprehend being gone? McDonald's is gone. I'll never get a hamburger.
I think it went, America is gone. Nah, too big. New York City. Nah, never really believed it was real anyway. McDonald's. Oh, that one hurts.
Feels a pang there. Has to stop thinking about it.
Arthur is, I don't want to say uninteresting, because actually there is humor coming out of him, even though he's the straight man, but definitely the straight man type of jokes, you know, again, like, oh my, when they get picked up by the Heart of Gold, oh, my arm's running off into the sunset. Where am I going to wear my watch now?
Or, like, he asks for tea at, like, a kind of a funny moment. Yeah. Something like that. Like,
the universe is going to hell, and he's like, does anyone have tea?
Yeah. So the straight man, I mean, they always kind of get the shaft because they're funny, and without them it doesn't work, because then you just have a bunch of insane characters running around. But their jokes are never hilariously funny.
Yeah, their reactions to other people's jokes are where the humor comes from. Yeah. And so he's spending most of the time palling around with a Ford prefect.
Yep.
Who is named after an obscure car that I don't think was ever sold in the United States.
The prefect?
Yeah.
Or is the Ford prefect?
I think Ford made a car called the prefect, and it was probably one of their Europe-only cars. I'm going to guess it was a tiny, shitty little car.
If sitting there going, I know Ford. It's like a prefect. It's like a thing at a British school. I don't understand.
I probably should have looked it up, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to start bringing scholarship into this all of a sudden.
We don't want to ruin this book with facts.
And Ford is, after the first couple chapters, he doesn't get a ton of really quality FaceTime in this book. He actually comes into his own quite a bit more as you go through the series. But it just kind of hints at some of the things that we'll see later on. Like, he likes to drink, and he likes to party. On Earth, he had a tendency to go to parties, get hammered, and start making fun of astrophysicists.
Yeah.
What was the name of the game? It involves,
The drinking game?
Yeah. But you try to use your latent telepathic power to push a drink over and if it gets pushed towards you, you have to drink. And it's mentioned that Ford usually played to lose.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what he is. He's a hitchhiker. That's where he's where the title comes from, really.
He always carries a towel.
Yep. Always comes in handy. Because if you're carrying a towel, people will immediately assume that you're equipped for other things and will lend you small items.
You've got it together.
That's right.
Oh, he probably forgot his toothpaste, but I'm sure he normally has it because he has a towel.
Right, he has his towel. He must have lost his toothpaste. He probably had it to begin with. Here, have some toothpaste.
Yeah, so, but I agree, like, in the first couple chapters, Ford is really bringing in that humor aspect, and then he kind of takes a little bit of a backseat to Zaphod / Zaphod.
Yeah, because Zaphod is definitely where the most absurdity enters.
Yes.
In terms of characters, at least.
Like we were saying earlier, this is a guy who had a third arm sewn on.
And a second head, actually.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't born with that either.
Just wants to look cool.
Yeah, he just likes it. Performed some sort of bizarre brain-scrambling surgery on himself.
Yeah, signatured it.
Left his initials there.
So I was doing all this stuff trying to figure it out, and nothing seemed to work. And then I remembered that I had an aversion to green as a kid, so I filtered it through green and saw my own initials. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Oh, Zaphod.
I'm assuming that comes into play later.
Becomes president of the galaxy just so he can steal this ship.
Yeah.
And because he likes the attention.
Although apparently he's really good at it.
Yeah.
The main job of the president, by the way, is not to actually do anything, but to avert people's attention away from the fact that you have no power.
One can assume this is a comment on democracy.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the themes of the book, is governmental structure and process.
Yeah, the bureaucratic thread, especially early on, because Arthur, the book opens, which we skipped, but that's okay, yeah. The book opens with Arthur trying to prevent a construction crew from knocking his house down because they're going to build a bypass through the land that he's on. And he finally heard something of it and tried to go check it out at City Hall, and their planning department turns out to be like a locked file cabinet in a lightless basement bathroom stall with no stairs.
Yeah.
And a sign saying, beware of the leopard.
Yeah, beware of the leopard. And he finally gets to the bottom of the filing cabinet and sitting there.
And then the Vogons come by not too much later and destroy the whole Earth to make space for a hyperspace bypass. And, oh, stop complaining. The plans have been on file for 50 years at the nearest planning office.
Yeah, Alpha Centauri.
What do you mean you couldn't be bothered to go there? You deserve it, you bunch of lazy bastards.
It's only 4 light years away.
And the Vogons are known as the bureaucrats of the galaxy, so it's not that surprising coming from them.
Yeah, they have that quote about how they won't save their grandmother from
the bug-bladdered beast of Troll.
Yes, unless they go and get the form signed, notarized, stamped, argued, torn up, burned, whatever the whole process is. And I mean, aside from that initial parallel of the destroying of Arthur's house and the destroying of the Earth, then we get that whole, you know, commentary on the way bureaucrats work and how they're like, oh, well, no, we've been talking about this for a long time. You've had a chance to protest. Except it's all been underwater.
Here's the Hitchhiker's Guide entry on Vogons. Vogon constructor fleets. Here's what to do if you want to get a lift from a Vogon. Forget it. They are one of the most unpleasant races in the galaxy. Not actually evil, but bad-tempered, bureaucratic, officious, and callous. They wouldn't even lift a finger to save their own grandmothers from the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Troll without orders signed in triplicate, sent in, sent back, queried, lost, found, subjected to public inquiry, lost again, and finally buried in soft peat for 3 months and recycled as firelighters. The best way to get a drink out of a Vogon is to stick your finger down his throat, and the best way to irritate him is to feed his grandmother to the ravenous bug bladder beast of Troll. On no account, allow a Vogon to read poetry at you.
So ridiculous.
Alright, so, Marvin the Paranoid Android.
Which I am now convinced Radiohead got their song title from this book. It's like, hey, paranoid android. And I went, what?
Another thing I forgot to look up.
Radiohead. I believe it. I mean, although their, like, music is all mopey and depressed. Just like Marvin.
So, Marvin is the product of a company, the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation. Actually.
Yeah, and what they wanted to do was create robots that have real human personalities.
So here's Marvin, who is incredibly depressed.
Oh my gosh, he's absurdly depressed.
Absurdly theatrically depressed.
Yeah.
He goes out of his way to make sure that at all times people know he's depressed.
Yeah, just sighing, dragging his feet, constantly talking about how depressed he is.
He's a robot. He's complaining about how he has a pain on his left side.
Yeah.
When he has to walk somewhere, like, he's head down, shuffling, trying to make it look as difficult as possible to stand up and go somewhere.
And then I liked it when he was talking to Ford and Arthur, and he was, life, don't talk to me about life. And Arthur's like, no one even said anything about that. Just bringing up an old conversation. And he's, one of the things I also think is awesome about Marvin is just how pissed off he is at all the other robots.
Well, they are his opposite, first of all. Like, the doors are happy to slide open and close for you, which is such a ridiculous little touch. Just like, why did this company go to the trouble to make doors that are happy? Just make them into doors.
Yeah. Oh, I can tell the door's about to open for us because of the sense of smugness about it.
This intolerable sense of smugness.
And then the main ship's computer is
incredibly cheerful.
Yeah, insanely happy.
Hey guys, I'm Eddie!
How can I help you out?
And everyone's like, shut up. Even the non-depressed people find him too cheerful.
Yeah. But Marvin's, I'd say his claim to fame in this book is he is so depressed, and the mice / aliens that are trying to attack and kill Arthur for his brain don't succeed because the ship ends up, the other ship ends up basically shutting down because Marvin decided he wanted to talk to it. And it got so depressed that it committed suicide. And so he inadvertently saved them all.
And Marvin's one claim to being legitimately depressed is that he has this huge amount of processing power.
Uh-huh.
Like, he'll get bored and analyze, like, all of the atoms in a certain volume of space or, you know, something that sounds time-consuming, and it takes him, like, a second.
Yeah.
And then they're just having him walk down to the airlock and fetch a couple of dudes.
Yeah. Like, you keep guard, just, you know, hang out, never making him do anything. But.
And he seems to be one of those people who, well, robots, maybe. He seems to be one of those robots who kind of enjoys being depressed to some degree. Like, he goes so out of his way to let everybody know that he is all the time. I think we've all known a person or two like that. Every time you meet them, like, if you ever have a complaint, like, even if you usually don't complain, they're the one who always has to one-up it.
Yeah. Oh, you think that's bad.
Here's what happened to me today.
My life is living pain.
You just enjoy being miserable, don't you?
Oh, yes. I know people like that.
So our next Earthling in the cast is Trillian.
Trillian.
Who Zaphod picked up at a party, apparently, a few months ago. One where Arthur was trying to pick her up at the same party. And the phone number for that place happens to be the same power of two that the improbability of picking them up out of empty vacuum when they got thrown out of the Vogon ship. This weird coincidence.
Because of the improbability drive?
The improbability drive basically takes things that are virtually impossible and makes them necessary. I think that would be the best way
to
put it.
And so when you're around the improbability drive, it's not that some things that are super improbable happen. It's like, just think of the most insane improbable thing that could happen, and it's going to happen.
Right, yeah. Oh, let's see, what was the what was the line about how it actually got invented, like some grad student?
They had finite improbability drives, but they couldn't create an infinite one until scientists finally concluded that it must be impossible or nearly impossible. And then that student realized, oh, if it's nearly impossible,
then it's finite and we can assign a number to it.
Exactly. And then managed to get it out of there. And then he got burned or hanged.
Yeah,
or
basically lynched because nobody likes a smart ass.
Yeah.
Which our grandmother would approve of.
Yes. She would love that shit. But other than that, so Trillian, she's kind of, she's not necessarily the straight man, but she's the competent person.
Yeah, every crew of, every ragtag band of misfits needs one token competent person to keep them from all accidentally killing themselves.
Yeah.
And that's kind of Trillian's job.
She does okay, more or less.
Well, Zaphod's not very good at planning.
Yeah.
Or thinking things through. Like, he has this kind of weird sort of eccentric genius about him, but she's the one who probably remembers to do things like make sure they eat and learn how to actually fly the ship they just stole. Yeah.
So with all of those characters that we've been talking about, one of the things that you maybe have gathered by now is that we know something about all these characters, but I think it's more important that they all fulfill a role. And in this book, the emphasis is more on comedy and the part that they play in the overarching comedy, and not necessarily who they are as a character.
Yeah, definitely. It actually reminds me of a couple other stories that I like, or shows that I like, that, again, kind of have this band of misfits, and most of them, or all of them, you don't really get to know in depth, especially at first.
Mm-hmm.
But you just kind of watch them bounce off of each other, and that's where the and come up with just improbable, ridiculous situations for them to be in.
Yeah.
And that's where the humor comes from.
And as we've already said, this book doesn't really have much of a plot, and it's not that deep. You know, the humor's excellent and actually at times subtle, but the characters themselves are not getting down too far into the realm of having more than one or two characteristics.
We get to know them better over the course of five books. And it's been a long time since I've read anything after this one. But my memory is that you don't, like, you spend a lot of time with them, but I'm not sure you ever get to know any of them deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it's all just absurdist when you come right down to it.
And at some point, I mean, if you're doing absurdist comedy and you make your characters into real people, then you're not writing absurdist comedy anymore.
True.
Because one of the purposes of absurdist comedy is to be so far out there that a real person would never do that.
Right.
We were reading a play for class, and someone just makes the comment of, I don't find this believable. And the teacher's like, good, it's absurdist comedy. Like, this is supposed to seem like the most impossible thing that people could ever do.
Right.
Like, in what situation would an audience member ever walk on stage in the middle of a play and all the actors would just keep going with their lines like nothing happened? Like, that would not happen.
Right.
Unless you were in an absurdist comedy.
Right.
And that's kind of the vein that Douglas Adams is going off of, for sure. Is he's not worrying too much about any of that realistic stuff. Especially with the improbability drive, that kind of, and the unreliable narrator bit, that kind of screws it up even more. So.
Yeah, well, the unreliable narrator is almost a character in and of himself, and
mm-hmm.
in this kind of writing, definitely. So, I know we've been saying over and over again, there's not a ton of depth, but let's examine some of the issues, if there are any to examine.
Oh, yeah, we did come up with some.
I think we came up with one or two, at least. So, there is, I guess, the depth of the book would be the little satirical moments.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are definitely a couple things in there. We already mentioned a bureaucracy.
Uh-huh.
He definitely pokes fun at that and at government, the president not actually having power, just being there basically to be entertaining. Which is a system of government I would advocate moving towards, actually. and also this thread of the ultimate question and the ultimate answer, of the life, the universe, and everything. What is the meaning of it all? And he has this this organic computer, or I guess it's not an organic computer, but this supercomputer that's going to answer that question. And it comes up with the answer, but it doesn't have the question. And so it designs a computer which happens to be Earth, which needs 10 million years to generate the question that goes with that answer. And as part of that, there's this pretty funny interplay between the people programming the computer and the computer, and between the people programming the computer and the Philosopher's Guild.
Yeah.
Who's upset that they're going to answer the ultimate question and put them out of business. And kind of like the silly... I mean, technically they're not human, but basically like the silly human petty things that go with that.
Yeah, you can't do that because now we don't have anything to argue over anymore, and you'll put us out of a job. Like, hey, it's going to take, 7.5 million years to answer, to come up with this answer. That means you guys have 7.5 million years to promote this and get so much publicity off of it, trying to predict what the right answer could be. And then the philosophers end up going... okay, yeah, we can deal with that. But, when they burst in and you have, the older philosopher and the younger ridiculous one who has no idea what he's saying, and we demand answers and facts. No, actually, we demand the opposite of that. We demand vagueness.
We might or might not demand.
Yeah, we might or might not demand that you have no answers to our questions. But, yeah, the philosophers are, fighting to keep everything purposefully in the dark. And then you have the Earth, which, like Ben said, ends up being a supercomputer. It's going to take 10 million years to process the question. And then the Vogons blow it up.
5 minutes before it's going to spit out the answer. Oh, man. And even just the fact of the answer to the ultimate question being 42, is so absurd.
Yeah.
And, trying to figure out what the question to go with that would be. Well, is it 6x7? No one will ever buy that.
That's too obvious. They end up coming up with a...
how many roads must a man walk down?
that sounds pretty good.
Oh, 42. Okay.
Well, I actually think that's... I was pretty impressed with that, actually.
It was a good little bit of brainstorming.
Yeah. Yeah, so we kind of have this theme or this underlying issue of, whenever you ask people the big question, they already know what the big question is. You don't have to say it, but people are saying, what's the meaning of life? Is there a meaning in the universe? Is there a purpose to everything?
Right.
And this book's kind of taking that and playing with it a little bit.
Yeah, if you wanted to look, into it a layer deeper, which may or may not, probably not, at least early on, the intent, by saying the answer is 42, maybe Douglas Adams is telling us there isn't meaning to life, the universe, and everything. Get on with your silly little lives and enjoy it,
Mm-hmm. And maybe he's saying that people don't actually want to know. Because, the philosopher is saying, what are we going to do when we have that information?
Right.
What can we do with that?
And then there's kind of a little bit of a religious thread in there, too. He does, multiple places... he throws in jokes about a best-selling author who writes books about why God could not possibly exist.
Uh-huh.
And the thing with the babblefish.
The babblefish, which is you've probably heard of it because it's a translator online. And I'm 100% sure that's where that came from.
Yep.
But goes in your ear, translates what their brain waves and yours.
Yeah, turns mental energy, it takes in brain waves and turns it into some form of mental energy that your brain can actually interpret. So no matter what you're saying, I hear it in my own native language. Uh-huh.
And it's just so perfectly crafted and exactly working that it could never have happened by coincidence and therefore must have been made by a creator.
Right, faith is the opposite of proof. And here you've created something that proves that it only could exist with God.
Yeah.
Therefore, God proves his own non-existence by giving proof of his existence and disappears in a puff of his own logic.
Yeah.
And then what was it that happened to the people who made that argument? It was
something. It was something very silly.
But that's a little bit of it, too. Again, kind of poking fun at the philosophy part of it again, because Douglas Adams was an atheist and was friends with at least one prominent person in the modern atheist movement. And he kind of pokes fun at the people who believe that. I think he's really trying to poke fun at anyone who takes themselves too seriously.
Yeah, and that bit about, you know, proving the non-existence of God by proving the existence of God is definitely, like, making fun of the semantics people surround themselves when they're philosophizing. Oh, you said that we can't prove you exist because we have to take it on faith, but now we prove that you exist, so obviously you can exist. Like, what? That sounds like something you'd run into in, like, a philosophy 1000 class. Right. Like, your freshman year of college, someone who thinks they're all, like, deep and cool is like, hey guys, guess what I came up with? Like, shut up. You're an idiot.
Oh, I see. You got high last night and came up with an idea you thought was awesome at the time. Good job.
Are you still looking for that?
It's killing me that I can't remember what it was off the top of my head.
The argument goes something like this. I refuse to prove that I exist, says God, for proof denies faith, and without faith I am nothing. But, says man, the babblefish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It could not have evolved by chance. It proves you exist, and so therefore, by your own arguments, you don't. QED. Oh dear, says God, I hadn't thought of that, and promptly vanishes in a puff of logic. Oh, that was easy, says man, and for an encore goes on to prove that black is white and gets himself killed on the next pedestrian crossing. That's what it was.
Black is white. Yeah, this book is hilarious.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous.
I would say definitely if you want to enjoy it, I think some of the stuff that we've been talking about is definitely there. You don't have to read too hard to get it, but that you don't have to try and read for deep stuff when you read this book. And actually, if you do, you might get pissy.
Well, if you're like us and you pick it apart and analyze it and try to figure out all the little aspects of it, then yeah, you can get there, but you're probably not. And, you know, the reason that I loved it, especially when I was younger, but still to this day, is because it's just a quote engine.
Yeah.
And there are, oh my God, there are 100 quotable lines in this first book, which takes about like 6 minutes to read.
Oh, I think it's barely over. It's like 50,000-60,000 yeah, words.
It's so short.
It's novella length. And Douglas Adams has a habit, or in this narrative has a habit of hopping off to, you know, oh, here's a random fact about something that happened to an alien on this other planet for half a page, which just generates tons of comedy. Like, here's a bunch of random crap that has nothing to do with what you're reading about. And this was one of those books where I got, you know, 3/4 of the way through and went, this, I don't think this book has a plot. And then I was like, but I don't really care.
Yeah, like, definitely in a lot of stories that would bother me. Unless it was, so, you know, there are only a couple types of books that cannot have a plot and get away with it. I would say something kind of absurdist comedy like this, okay, everything that's happening is just to make you laugh anyway. Mm-hmm. And the plot thread is usually tenuous because it's supposed to be just enough that you have something in common with the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I guess, would be like a more of a character study,
mm-hmm,
where things happen to people in the story but don't necessarily have to go anywhere, like Atonement a little bit.
Yeah, or when we talked about A Handmaid's Tale, that was,
or Handmaid's
pretty
Tale,
similar to that.
Yeah, we decided that one was largely plotless.
And yeah, it definitely can work if you're a good writer.
Right, well, because both of those books we just referenced are really good.
Yeah, one of the things about this Douglas Adams book is it's not just like some jackass sitting down and writing a string of jokes. Because that's not funny for 50,000 words.
Like, right,
yeah. To write a really funny comedy, you have to be really fucking funny.
Yeah, this isn't like just somebody's Twitter feed that somebody took 8 months worth of and bound.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there actually is there's a consistency to it. You know, like, there's almost a plot to the humor in some ways. Like, the Hitchhiker's Guide entries are a thread that keep it tied together.
Uh-huh.
Or like I mentioned, the digital watches is kind of a running gag. Or once the Heart of Gold gets into it, even before Zaphod steals the ship, there's some of that improbability stuff. It becomes a running thread. Like, it was being built on an island that was coincidentally called France.
Yeah.
Has nothing to do with Earth or the English language. It was just purely coincidental.
It just happened to be called France.
Right. Or how about, like, in the second half of the book, the Magrathians, the planet builders, and the hyper-intelligent pan-dimensional beings who manifest as mice in our reality.
Yeah, on Earth.
Yes. All of them have such ridiculous names. Like, they're all clearly really close to swear words and dirty phrases in the English language, but modified just a little bit. And another thing that I meant to look up was, you know, Slartabartfast apparently comes from... I remember it had something to do with the sexual act with a dog, I'm pretty sure.
Slartabartfast.
Yes.
Well, like, the computer programmer's name, who's like, Fook or something.
Right, one of them is like, Fook.
Fook. Yeah, F-O-O-K, yeah. And there's like a P-H-U-O-K or something.
Yeah, like the his 7-million-year descendant.
Yeah.
And the other guy had a really great name. Magic Thighs. That was the one I was trying to come up with earlier. They're just all really, really silly.
Yeah, so Douglas Adams, I mean, is a master of his craft for sure. So, you know, don't read the book for plot. But if you want to read some first-rate, hilarious stuff, I would definitely recommend this book.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, I guess let's get into wrap-up mode, more or less, here. We're getting right around there, aren't we?
Yep.
So, context and relevance for the book today.
Well, I think you're more qualified to talk about that than I am.
Yeah, I've read a couple of... there are a couple author blogs I read, and I know that... John Scalzi definitely has written about this in the past, just as an example. But it's actually part of the influence of this book from an author standpoint is somewhat negative. Because if you are a science fiction writer and you want to write something with humor in it, like, this is the mold that publishers kind of expect it to be in.
Uh-huh. So if you write a science fiction comedy... but not absurdist comedy, or, like, have a different kind of thread in there, well, it's not enough like Douglas Adams, it's not going to sell, so they won't publish it.
Yeah, it's an idea that certain publishers have had. I mean, it's certainly not completely widespread, and it's certainly there are people who have managed to write somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but if you're a science fiction author, and especially if you're not English,
yeah,
and I think that's what he... I think that's what I remember from the... article he'd posted about it was that it's not as much the absurdist thing, but they want like the dry British feel to it. And well, if you're an American author, maybe you don't want to do that. Now that being said, John Scalzi is an interesting example to use because he's actually had some success writing humor books in science fiction. He has one called The Android's Dream, and the first chapter is essentially a subtle prolonged fart joke. It's definitely not dry or British. Or he actually just released a book called Red Shirts that he certainly doesn't need my help plugging, but I know that his best-known book is probably Old Man's War, and Red Shirts has apparently sold more books in the first 2 weeks than Old Man's War did in the entire first year it was on the shelves. And Red Shirts is, you can almost tell by the title, right?
Yeah.
Is strictly humor. Like, it's supposed to be funny.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't had the chance to read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. But, yeah, I mean, that's one prominent example that I can come up with. One guy. And I've read lots of other stuff that's a little tongue-in-cheek at times, but nothing that's definitely humor as the primary genre.
Mm-hmm.
Other than Terry Pratchett.
Well, yeah, and like you said, he's fantasy humor.
And he's English.
Yeah, and you've read a lot more sci-fi than I have, but when I think of it, I tend to think of the more, you know, epic, serious-minded stuff than the goofy stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely more big idea-oriented and a little bit less, let's just take a cute story that happens to have space.
Yeah. So... Verdict for the book. Or no, I guess questions for the series.
Oh, yeah. So, what is the ultimate question?
Yeah. We have what they came up with. How many roads must a man walk down? But what is it?
What is the real answer?
And I asked this earlier in the podcast, but why did Zaphod decide to fry his brain? What was he trying to hide from himself?
Yeah, they never get around to that. This book almost feels like half a novel in some ways. Because it just kind of... Because it doesn't do much, and it kind of ends abruptly, and the two main questions are never answered.
Yeah. Let's go get something to eat at the restaurant at the end of the universe.
That's right.
I guess, well, that's book two, so...
All right, I guess that's what's happening.
Would you recommend it?
Hells yeah.
Yeah. I think both of us have already said that enough times.
We've made it pretty obvious we are heavily biased in favor of this book.
Doesn't take long to read. It's funny. If you don't like it, then whatever. You wasted like 2 hours.
Yeah, if you hate it, then you're not losing a lot. Though, I can't imagine you'd want to listen to us talk for over an hour every week if that's not your kind of humor. Yeah.
Also, I don't know how you don't think that at least part of the book isn't funny.
You know there's someone out there who doesn't think there's a single funny joke in
it.
Oh,
I'm sure.
And you know that it's probably like that... Ticket to the man, everyone likes it, so I refuse to,
yeah,
sort of thing.
That,
like,
sort of person.
There's just no plausible way to me that you wouldn't have a single joke in there hit.
I don't know why everyone thinks this is funny. Stupid.
Do you have a sense of humor? be like me with Anchorman.
Yeah, God.
Except that movie actually isn't funny, whereas this book is.
Again, showing your bias.
Yes, again, showing my bias. So, what you reading right now?
I actually just finished Sway, by, I think it's Ori and Rom Brafman, which is a nonfiction book that's looking at, the different sorts of things that influence people to make irrational decisions.
Yeah, I've read this book, too, and actually so has our dad, and, like, one of my favorite nonfiction books ever. It's really easy to read. And
yeah, it's short, and it's basically just a series of super interesting stories and studies about people doing things that you would not expect because of some kind of trigger pulling on them that's making them go in a way they wouldn't if they were using their logic.
Yeah, and that's almost a podcastable nonfiction book.
Yeah.
That's something we've thought about for those of you out there who are wondering. And haven't really figured out what a good format would be to discuss a nonfiction book in an entertaining way. But with that one, you could almost just relay, like, the best study from each chapter and talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Like the economics professor who auctions off a $20 bill and always sells it for way over 20 bucks.
Yeah. I think they said the most it ever went for was, like, $204 or something.
But yeah, like a business conference or something.
Yeah.
But even in a classroom where people don't have a lot of cash, he sells it for over 20 bucks
every single time.
So, yeah, just really interesting stuff like that. I am currently reading a book called Terminal World by Alistair Reynolds. And it's, I guess you would call it steampunk, but... He's a slightly harder science fiction guy, and the premise for this book is that there's this big spire that people live in, and for some reason, like, there's something at the center of it that makes it possible for technology to only exist up to a certain level in each strata of the tower. So, like, the people on the top level have all this, like, quantum technology. They're actually referred to as post-human because they have so many nano modifications to themselves. But on the bottom level, like, nothing gets anywhere past, like, horse and muscle power. And the protagonist has to flee the tower and is mostly stuck in steam era technology and lower once he's outside. So, kind of an interesting premise to force that to happen, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I guess...
That's all from us.
That's just about it. Yeah, if you have any thoughts, comments, love, hate, whatever for us, then feel free to leave a comment on the website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can also email us if you want to at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, you can hit us on Twitter, novelideaspod. Or if you're one of our iTunes listeners, you can comment, rate, review on iTunes, which we'd encourage you to do. We'd like to have more of it.
Let us know that you're listening, because we actually don't know who's listening through iTunes.
Yeah, that's true. We actually largely don't know who's listening in general, for that matter.
That's true.
So, you know, drop us a line if you have something to say. Tell all your friends who read that they should listen to us, etc. And is that it? Yeah. Oh, no, what are we reading next week?
Next week, you know, in 4 days or whatever, since we're a little off schedule.
Yeah, just vacation threw us off a bit.
We will be covering the YA classic Matilda by Roald Dahl.
Yep, another book that I just kind of, when I talk to someone who reads, I just kind of assume they know it.
That they've read it, yeah.
Especially if they're gifted, as we are.
And Roald Dahl, man, is so awesome.
Yeah, he's such a great combination. Like, I mean, he's obviously a well-known YA person. And he's just really good at creating characters that young people connect with, and creating these fantastical situations, and just like a little thread of darkness, too, that I find really fascinating in all of his stories, actually.
Which we will talk about more.
Yes, we'll definitely. Definitely. So I think that is actually it for this week.
Yep.
And
so please drop us a line. Let us know if you're listening. You don't really have to say anything, but we always love comments. So.
Yeah, just what up? Out. Right.
Oh my God.
3 comments this week. So that's it, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Whoa, what's happening? Who am I? Why am I here? What's my purpose in life? What do I mean by who am I? Okay, calm down, calm down. Get a grip now. Ooh, this is an interesting sensation. What is it? It's a sort of a tingling in my... Well, I suppose I better start finding names for things. Let's call it, tail. Yeah, tail. And hey, what's this roaring sound? Whooshing past what I'm suddenly going to call my head. Wind. Is that a good name? That'll do. Yay, this is really exciting. I'm dizzy with anticipation. Or is it the wind? There's an awful lot of that now, isn't there? And what's this thing coming towards me very fast? So big and flat and round, it needs a big wide-sounding name like ow, ound, round, ground. That's it, ground. I wonder if it'll be friends with me. Hello, ground.
Curiously, the only thing that went through the mind of the bowl of petunias as it fell was, oh, no, not again. Many have speculated that if we knew exactly why the bowl of petunias had thought that, we should know a lot more about the nature of the universe than we do now.